Okay, we'll go back into session and item six, Stepstone Group again, but this time the private credit implementation. Tim, do you have an introduction?
Sure, so a couple of years ago, when the board approved private credit allocation, we conducted a comprehensive search to find the right partner to help us implement that. Identified Stepstone and identified that Fund 01 is the most efficient way to implement a rather large allocation. So within this Fund 01, there are separately managed accounts, there are funds, there are co-investments, but it's all under the purview of the Stepstone Group, primarily based out of Zurich, represented by Urs von Buren and his colleague, Ariel, blanking on your last name?
Goldblatt.
So I'll let them give an update on what's been implemented to date. You'll recall they were here about a year ago talking about the initial stages of the implementation where we had about $200 million put to work. I think Urs made a comment exactly a year ago that when we're here next time, it should be about half implemented, and I think we're going to see it's about half implemented. Give you an update on the performance to date and the structure. So with that, I will turn it over to the Stepstone Group.
Thank you, Tim. Good morning, and thank you for having us again for this annual update. I'm Urs von Buren, a partner at Stepstone Group. I'm responsible for all investment-related activities in the private debt space. Together with Marcel Schindler, who was here last year, he leads all private debt activities. I'm one of the lead partners on this mandate. To my left is Ariel Goldblatt. She joined my team in April this year. She works in New York. She's responsible for co-investment activities in private debt. And Arias is also responsible for the day-to-day running of this mandate. I will guide through the first agenda items, and then Arias will take over for a mandate overview. I'll start with a market update, highlighting some concerns that were already raised last year, partially, and lay out how we at Stepstone address these challenges. I'm on slide 5. Some topical points that you may read in the press, that you may hear from people that are active in the space. You see a lot of capital has been raised on the top left. This combined with more funds being launched, the steepness is actually quite high. And on the bottom end, you see some deteriorating factors, such as covenant protection. A covenant allows a lender to step in on a quarterly basis if the borrower doesn't perform as expected. So it allows you to take action and ask for more equity or action mitigating factors. So they're quite important. And you see they're reducing, and at the same time, also in this market, middle market, the leverage is also increasing. Not quite as high as in syndicated markets, but nevertheless, it's going up. On slide 6, two other areas where it goes about weakening lender protection. You see the covenant headroom. At the beginning of a credit, one always has a plan, and then obviously one gives the borrower a certain level of headroom to move within this plan, and a covenant bites when like about 25-ish% of that target is not achieved. If that headroom is widened to like 30, 35, 40, 50%, that's obviously bad for the lender. Now you see that it has gone up a bit, but not dramatically. What we're focusing on here is exaggerations, because there are exaggerations where we see 40, 50 and more percent headroom. We try to eliminate these by implementing certain measures with the managers we work with. EBITDA adjustments, that's EBITDA, Tom explained before, is a measure of returns of a company. And if a company is being purchased, it goes about synergies, if they make an acquisition, cost savings, etc., forward-looking expectations, but they're not actually here today. Now, sometimes these expectations are going a bit out of bound, so they're very they're exaggerated over 2-3 years, and then is lent against this number. And that's not a very cautious approach. You can see the average again, it goes slightly up of these adjustments. It's not overall that worrisome, but again, there are exaggerations. We sometimes see 40, 50, 60% EBITDA adjustments, and that allows a company to lend much more money than it actually should based on current ability to generate returns. So we try to address those as well with measures and work with the manager. Now, I showed the growth of the market earlier on. You see here in the US and Europe the disintermediation of banks. I know it's a topic that you've heard several times, but it is continuing. We don't have the 2018 numbers yet, but the trend is similar. Especially in Europe, it keeps on going down. So the private markets are also growing just because the banks are doing less. It's not that per se the amount of debt is increasing that much. The amount of debt grows a little bit with GDP. It's just a shift from banks to non-bank lenders. On page 8, you see some middle market, some numbers about the market sizes. You see the high-yield bond market, which you're also invested in, syndicated loan market, and the direct lending market. That's the companies with EBITDAs between 5 and 75-ish million. This is an estimate, but we're actually feeling quite confident about this number. Europe is about 3 times smaller, and Asia is tiny. There's just very little going on, but we believe that's something interesting for the future. So it's a very large market, this middle market lending that you're invested in, largely through this mandate. Remind you that this is illiquid, very small loans, average is 100 million, the range is about 50 to 250 million. They do not trade. They sit on the originators' funds and vehicles, one of which is yours, and wait to be repaid over time, and there's no trading. Now, what do we do to address these concerns that I kind of laid out a bit? On page 10, you already saw this one. There is still a lot of equity involved in the markets. I'm not going to repeat what Tom said, but there is a lot of equity or capital behind. So the skin in the game of the owners of the borrowers is quite high. The next slide, persistent returns through the cycle, slide 11. The risk-adjusted direct lending yields have actually remained attractive through the cycle. I'll walk you through an example of what these slides actually say. It says, if you take 2007, all credits that were given in the year 2007 generated a gross asset yield, a return, annualized, of 9.9%. Now, the losses that suffered, that's probably the better word, on an annual basis, out of these 2007 credits was 266 basis points every year, and that's how the chart can be read. So the 2007 cohort still generated net returns, also gross returns before fees, of more than 700 basis points. Now, what this doesn't say, when these losses happen, because these losses happened for the 2007 space in kind of like 2009, 10, 11, and a little bit in 12. Also, the 2006 losses of 144 basis points happened in roughly the same period, because that was the global financial crisis and the aftermath and the cleaning up of these problems. The important point is there was never a negative year in any of these, even if you show all the losses, how they happened on an annual basis. So it's a very stable class, asset class, if you have the stamina to stay in. Now, it's illiquid, as I said. If you want to go and sell, your discounts will be substantial. But if you actually stick to it, the return expectations over the long run are fairly stable. So it's an attractive profile, we say. When I move to page 12, we try to show here a bit market on the left with an EBT and leverage range, so the level of indebtedness of about 5.4 down to 2.4 with an average of 4.1. That's like the 10th to the 90th percentile. When we apply the guidelines that we usually negotiate with managers, the top comes down almost a full turn. So the one narrows the level of indebtedness and reduces the average quite a bit as well. So that's how we try to contain these exaggerations that tend to happen end of the cycle. Similar on the right with the loan to value, so the debt in comparison to the value of the company. A fairly broad range, 64 to 20, 29 on the market, and with the guidelines that we apply, we reduce that quite a bit. This is based on several thousand loans that we have on our database. We probably have the biggest database on single loans that you can find anywhere. On slide 13, the importance of covenants is kind of illustrated here with the loss experience that one has if there is no covenant. So if a company does have experience a loss, in average, one loses about 2%. If there is one covenant, that already halves to kind of 96 basis points. And if there are two or more, it reduces again to about 60 basis points. The marginal gain for more than two is very tiny because additional covenants are a bit less. The leverage covenant is the most important, and additional covenants tend to be have less weight. We do insist on our managers having covenants. This is true for kind of 97 to 98% of all investments that we have. There are specific GPs where we allow to purchase certain loans in the secondary market that may not have a covenant, but then they buy them at 90 or 92. It's like an opportunistic secondary purchase, and one of the managers that you have has that ability, and that's why you will see you have 97% loans that have a covenant and about 3% don't have one, but they are not newly originated loans. That's an opportunistic secondary purchase.
John?
Yes, if I could go back to page 7 for just a moment. Looking at the pattern of bank to private debt firms in both of the charts, the first thing that jumps out to me is, do the banks know something that the private debt firms don't?
I can start on that just in terms of the thesis of why we started looking at private credit, and I think this trend was a large portion of why we found private credit to be attractive. In general, this is being driven by increased regulatory requirements on the banks, which makes it more difficult to originate and hold these loans, even if they are attractive investments. The reserves that they're having to hold against these loans are increasingly prohibitive, and it takes a lot of the return expectations out of the equation for the banks. So I think by and large, most, not all, most banks would prefer to be more active in the space and have been regulated out of it.
Maybe just to add on that, the bank space that still remains is about 20%. And that's mainly focused on revolvers. That's, that finances the daily liquidity of a borrower. And amortizing loans that have a short average life. Those are actually still quite attractive for the banks. Anything that has a legal life of 5 years or more has exactly the issues that Tim pointed out. So the combination of banks providing the more day-to-day financing and the non-banks providing the term loans, the longer term, is actually a very good one. And that's where the banks still remain active. Now, if you read in the press, there's about four or five fairly active banks, BMO, Citizens, and others, that are still actively participating in this market, but they syndicate a lot out to other participants. So it's like a club of four or five lenders that then provide such a loan, because a Citizen wants to hold about 20, 25 million on a single credit, whereas they used to hold 75 or more. And to organize a club, it's always the lowest common denominator. You need to wait till everybody has its okays from all his committees. It's a very cumbersome process, and a lot of private equity firms prefer to go to a non-bank that takes the full 150 million or 100 million, stands up for it, and they're done. So there's a lot of underlying soft factors that drive this development as well.
Thank you.
On page 14, we seek to work with managers that are sole arrangers or arrange or co-lead a transaction. The reasons are illustrated in these two charts. The one on the left is the loss-adjusted gross asset yield, so it's the gross asset yield minus the losses that occurred, and that's, you know, 8.8% versus 8.3 or 8 is obviously a much more attractive number. And also the relative return per in terms of the indebtedness, that's actually something similar like the Sharpe ratio that was mentioned earlier. What do I earn per kind of risk measure that I take is also significantly better when the manager you work with is the sole or co-lead, because they control the situation much tighter and don't have to go and convene with 5, 6, 7 other guys how to talk to the borrower. They can talk much more directly. That's kind of like the key reason on that. Before I get to a summary on that, on page 15, what I tried to say here is that diversification is your friend. It's a very different asset class than private equity. In private equity, diversification actually dilutes your returns. In private credit, that's not the case, because you will have some losses, but given that you have no upside, you don't miss out on something that makes 5, 6, 7 times the money. So you have on the left kind of the average loan fund has about 35 to 40 positions. The average portfolio on the StepStone platform has almost 200 credits. Actually, you have some more. And then the loss variance, this is pure mathematics based on the loss experience in the past. The range of outcome if you have a single fund between almost nothing if you're lucky, but up to 3.1% of losses just because of you're not diversified. If you diversify beyond 150 or more, your max loss just comes down substantially. It's kind of half. And that can be really has a substantial impact on your long-term success in a program. So diversification is your friend. Now, lessons learned from previous cycles. I think I can say that because I've been doing this for more than 30 years. Role of structures. As Tim said, you have your own structure. You have your own managed accounts. Yes, you have some fund investments as well, but the majority is in structures that you control. And you can influence, and you also control the cash movements. This is not a security that is settled through official settlement houses. It's still a lot of paperwork. So governance and control an important factor. Credit quality, quite obvious, but one needs to maintain the discipline to keep it up over time. Diversification, I think I don't need to repeat myself. And on the deployment, most private credit is a replacement of fixed income. So you want to earn a yield. And given that loss experience that I showed earlier, if you try to time the market and don't invest and wait for better times, your opportunity costs are absolutely massive. Because having 200, 300, or 500 million invested or wait for a better time in the market costs you 7, 8, 9, 10% every year, which you can never catch up again. So deployment is important. Timing the market is not recommendable. Retain flexibility. Again, with your setup, you have that flexibility to adjust and adapt to market changes and take advantage of opportunities that may open up during a dislocation. On number six, it's a very obvious statement, but people should be aware of it. The return dispersion in senior first lien loans that you're in is actually quite small. You know, the top quartile and the bottom quartile in private equity is absolutely humongously different. In private debt, yes, you need good managers and you need discipline, but the ultimate outcome is fairly narrow. If you choose to work with people that remain disciplined. That leads me to number seven. The risks that we have seen or the losses that we have seen occur in the past usually have come from non-core activities of a manager. So style drift, they start to do things they haven't done before because they cannot achieve the target returns that they tried to, so they do funny stuff. And that's where it usually goes wrong. That again, that's why we recommend our clients, and you do that as well, set up managed accounts, set a box within which the manager can work and protect from such style drifts. Are there questions to the market? Because I would now move on to the mandate.
Does anyone have any questions? Not seeing any. Okay.
As Tim said, you approved this mandate in April 2017 as us as an implementation partner, and we started in investing in H2 2017, or the implementation, and started investing early 2018. We have bi-weekly calls with your investment team, and the ramp-up speed has kind of stayed the same since the beginning. We want to be ramped over about 3 to 4 years, and it includes also, the mandate includes managed accounts, primary funds, and co-investments. They are limited currently at 200 million. We agreed a milestone with the team of 75 million. To kind of assess how it's going and whether that then shall be increased or not. And that milestone will be reached during this quarter. So far we have committed a total of about 800 million to different managers, and obviously discussed lots of different proposals. The outlook for next year, there should be a continuation of the implementation. It's largely on plan. So far, the NAV here, it says 486 million, but it's actually a little bit more than 500 as of now. So, as Tim said, pretty much where we thought we would end up. We plan to have a fourth managed account, two or three additional primary fund commitments, and then get to the 75 million co-invest and see whether we grow that from there. One point that is not on here is the monitoring. We obviously spend a lot of time on monitoring our investments on a quarterly basis. We have very detailed calls with all the managers and obviously make sure that what we expect to be done is actually done as well. Because it's nice to set some guidelines, but one needs to make sure that they're also adhered to. On page 90, just the key areas of the mandate. It shall be a 10% yielding investment over a cycle. It should grow to roughly 12% of your assets overall. It's mainly a corporate debt mandate. It is managed accounts, primary funds, co-investments, and possibly secondaries, if and when they are interesting. And we want to retain some flexibility. So a lot of the things that we learned over time are implemented, and this has not changed since we actually got the approval to do this. On the next page, number 20, the number is missing with all the pictures. Since last year, we had 6 joiners in the private debt team on the left, 2 leavers. No change at the partner level, but IU Nicholson was promoted to partner earlier this year. And the last slide I'm going to talk about is just to re-emphasize that we apply the same investment process throughout the firm. The highlight that I'd like to emphasize is that there's a lot of emphasis on operational due diligence to really understand how the managers work, how the cash flows are being controlled. And the other part I'd like to emphasize is it's a very data-intensive approach. StepStone has a huge number of data and that helps to compare managers, to analyze single loans, to analyze what works and what doesn't work, and helps us obviously to set these credit boxes to make sure that we have a long-term successful relationship with the managers we work with. With that, I hand over to Ariel.
Thanks, Horst. So you're going to see a lot of similar pages as you did on the private equity side, on the private debt, as we tried to be consistent. As Orr's mentioned, you know, our ramp-up speed has remained largely unchanged, and it's in line with our expectations and where we thought we would be, with the goal to get to about 12% of Cesera's AUM. In terms of our priorities for 2020, we're looking to commit to one new SMA, about $150 to $200 million, and then add about 2 new primary funds. And as we discussed about co-investments, we'll reach that 75 million milestone by the end of the year and then either reinvest those proceeds or move towards the next milestone. And right now, as we also mentioned, you're currently at a little bit above $500 million for NAV, and we'll be right at about that $600 million by year end. If we go to slide 23, I think the key takeaways really from this slide is that, you know, we have worked in coordination with the Cesera team. We have biweekly calls and, you know, where we can coordinate on new opportunities. And so when you think about all the opportunities that have been arranged or reviewed over the last, since inception, you'll see that, you know, we've arranged over 20 due diligence visits from our pre-selected GPs. We've also reviewed, you know, almost 150 primary and co-investment opportunities that are reflected in and then dwindled down into what ends up being in your portfolio. So we've continued to work, and we'll continue working going forward in close coordination with, you know, with Tim and Rishi and the Cesera team. If we then move, if there are no questions there, we can move on to the performance and go to slide 25. I think what's important, there are two different pieces I wanted to talk about on this slide. First is on actual performance. So what you'll see is that as of June 30th, you've committed, you know, about $650 million to 18 different investments, which includes 2 new SMAs, a third was introduced, 3, 4 primary funds, and then 12 co-investments. for in terms of how much your portfolio has drawn since June 30th, you've drawn over $200 million and received $31 million in distributions. And the portfolio generated a net gain of almost $26 million, resulting in a gross IRR of 12.7% over the last year and a net IRR of 11.6%. And then as you think about it, since inception, your gross IRR has increased almost 260 bips, to about 12.5%.
Question. Do you have a breakdown of the managers in terms of who's in the fold at this point? And I noticed in one of the charts there referred to by letters, I think. And maybe I missed the legend.
We were asked to keep the names confidential, but yes, we have a breakdown of all the managers in your portfolio.
Jerry?
Yeah, once again, I'm going to start trying to be more consistent about my emphasis on trying to figure out the difference between gross and net. This is an Easter egg hunt for me. You've got footnotes all over the place. On the top of this page, it says gross and net. Then in the middle of the chart, it says gross, but then it's got a footnote that says net. So you have to go down to the footnote to find out what net is. I'd like to know from time to time and report to report and manager to manager what we as a fund are netting out of our efforts. And that the same question goes on to page 26. Same difficulties, those three sets of bars down there. I don't know whether or not they're gross figures. In fact, it even qualifies it. It says on the next page that they're net of partner fees, but not net of stepstone fees. This is just too complicated. I'd like to have it all in a nice little code that says net, what we are as a plan getting out of this from time to time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we can do is, next time we'll note that we can add net so that you can see both the gross and the net and understand that. And I apologize, that footnote is small. So, you know, as of June 30th, your net IRR since inception is 10.4%.
Yeah.
That's really the net number. The reason why we did this here, just to be transparent, is, you may recall, we have a flat fee agreed with you, which since the start of the mandate, and obviously at the beginning, that fee in basis points or IRR is quite a bit because you start investing at zero, and it reduces to very few basis points now. So the difference between net of manager fees, which we show here is the 12.5%, and then deducting our fee, that will narrow down massively once you get closer to the 1 billion.
Right.
But just, I think the result, 12.5% after all the management fee, is actually a very good one. And because of that slight dilution of a flat fee that we have, that brings it down to 10.4, that in 2 or 3 years' time you'll be very close to 12.5%. Through that. That's the reason why we didn't show it that way. But I hear your
request. Okay. It may be just me, but I'm having trouble following this without wading through footnotes and trying to figure out how they differ from page to page.
Yeah. Now that we're 2.5 years into this partnership with StepStone, and we're discussing performance, it might be a good opportunity for Tim to just briefly comment on kind of our initial expectations and where we're at now, and kind of what that looks like.
Yeah, I'd say, we initially identified private credit as an asset class we wanted to pursue back in 2015. So this has been going on for a while. We got through the research process to say who was going to be our implementation partner really in 2017. Identified StepStone and said, we've come up with the structure, the opportunity set was still there. We negotiated a fee structure we thought was quite advantageous to Cicera, and now we're in the implementation phase. And initially when we started in 2017, I think we said, to get this up and running, 3 to 4 years to get the dollars deployed. The SMA is separately managed account, so we have a direct, or through the fund will have a direct relationship with an underlying manager to deploy the capital. That goes a little bit faster, the funds go a little bit slower, but we did want to be methodical about this. It's a large allocation for Contra Costa, keeping in mind, we have a 12% target to this. Roughly want to put $1 billion to work too quickly. We want to be able to diversify across a couple of vintage years and across time.
but we're about halfway through, a little more than halfway through that time period we had envisioned to get it up and running. And I think what we're seeing here is the early results, and we're going to caveat that these are early results, are in line with expectations, or actually a little bit higher than the going-in expectations. In terms of a 12 and a half or a 10 net, I think we were talking about roughly 10 net over a market cycle, but clearly we're not a market cycle into this yet.
And then the only other point I wanted to make is just in terms of the quality of portfolio that Sisera has. This is, as Orsa discussed earlier in the market section, this is a very high-quality portfolio when you think about all in leverage at about 4x, almost 100% senior secured loans, and almost 100% covenanted. And the four borrowers that are not covenanted are relate only to one specific GP, and who, as Orsa described, has discretion, some little wiggle room to make purchases opportunistically in the secondary market, but obviously very little wiggle room on that. So we have obviously tried to make sure that you have a very high quality portfolio. If you move to slide 26, we've talked a lot about benchmarks today. Unfortunately for private debt, it is really hard to find a good benchmark for private debt that's actually apples to apples. The Cliffwater benchmark is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a pretty as pretty good benchmark as we can find right now. A lot of the other benchmarks are just too small. They only cover 100 borrowers, and the data is spotty. The Cliffwater benchmark covers 6,000 borrowers. It's all North American, in line with your portfolio. So even though there are some things that aren't perfect about it because it has some sub-debt in it versus, all senior secured for your portfolio, this is really probably the best we can find to date. And as you can see, as Tim just described, the returns, these are early returns. They've been in line with expectations and have outperformed so far the Cliffwater benchmark. I don't know if there are any other questions, but on that page, I know we've probably beaten the benchmarks a little bit today. So if we move to slide, sure.
But on page 26, if you were to look at those blue bars, if you were to take out Stepstone fees, what would the quarter-to-date figure be, the one-year-to-date figure, and the since inception figures be?
So so the since inception, I think, is 10.4%. And just want to know that the Cliffwater is gross as well, just so you know. So we are trying to be apples to apples, but for since inception, it's about 10.4. The 1 year is similar, about down 200 bips-ish. And the quarter-to-date is quarter out of that.
So, I'm sorry, I missed that.
I think it would be about 25 bips below where it is today.
Because the quarter now, the assets now are like roughly 500 million. So the fee has a much smaller impact now. So it would be still a sweep for the quarter today.
Net.
Deducting our fees.
Roughly 3% net.
3%. Okay.
So that's what I meant. This difference is reducing massively.
Okay. I mean, I take the limitations of the benchmark. I get that. I'm just trying to figure out what the net is to Sisera.
So that 10.4 just would not compare apples to apples to the Cliffwater because that's gross.
Okay.
It's again Cliffwater kind of high. And there's no manager there.
Thanks for clearing this up for me. I thought I understood it until you cleared it up for me.
No. So that's why we're showing the 12 and a half, because that's as apples to apples as we can get with the Cliffwater benchmark.
Okay. Work in progress. Thank you.
Yeah, so apologies for that. If you look at slide 27, this is, you're still relatively early days. In your cycle, you've had about a 26 million year-over-year gain as of June 30th. This is driven primarily by manager B&A or two SMAs you have, and then the balance is, which makes up about 70% of the gain, and then the balance is, primary funds and co-investments. And then one key point I wanted to make is that, since July 1st, as you move to Q3, an additional 140 million has been deployed. It's primarily related to one of your SMAs as well as the addition of a new SMA. So what I want to show you then on the next slide, if you look on slide 28 and you see the cash flow movement, you'll see in Q3 this $140 million deployment. So this is not, this is a relative anomaly, right? So I would expect for Q4 and going forward, you'll be more in that $50 to $75 million range of deployment per quarter. And as I said, we have all of the names. If you wanted them, we were asked to keep them confidential on who the managers are. And then, you know, the other point I wanted to make, as of 6:30, you'll see that our SMAs represented about 67% of deployment. Our primaries were about 20%, and our co-investments made up the balance about 15 to 17%. And then with the addition of the new SMA, you'll see new SMA this quarter in Q3, you'll see SMAs now become more like 75%. Primaries will drop down to about 12 to 13%, and co-investments about 10%. And we'll have that reporting for you shortly. And then on the last page, you know, as we think about your portfolio and its composition and exposure and diversification, direct lending makes up 90% of the Sicera portfolio. The balance is real estate and regulatory capital strategies. So these are a little bit, these are specialty strategies. And as I just mentioned, you know, about 70% of the portfolio is comprised of your SMAs, 20% for primary funds, and the remainder in co-investments. The portfolio is 100% North America. And then in terms of industry diversification, what you're going to see is that you're pretty well diversified. The one area I would point out is consumer discretionary, which is about 30%. But this includes services as well, so this is why it's looks a little outsized. But when you think about how big consumer discretionary is, it's services, apparel, durables, media, leisure, education services, etc. So that's why this looks a little bit bigger. And that's why I wanted to make sure to highlight that in case there's any questions on it.
Mike, you had a question?
Yes. I'm fairly new to this process. And so the question I have is, what is the reasoning behind keeping the manager's names confidential?
I can address that. Because our relationship is with StepStone at the top level, and StepStone, the fund, will have the underlying relationships, it's a little bit trickier to have those names in the public domain. We can certainly have a conversation about them, but it's the same structure we have with fund of funds. The relationships with the top level, you can get some clarity to the underlying, but in a public domain, it's not disclosable.
Good. Thank you.
Any other questions at this time?
Okay. Please continue. Thank you very much.
Great. Yeah. Oh, you're done. Okay.
It's the final question that happened, but you didn't realize that we're actually done.
So, I thought it was interrupting. So.
And then suddenly people go, I would have had.
Okay. All right. I'm not seeing any other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.